the first case, please.
Sherry Dina David against Robert C. Davis. John E. Davis, the appellant. Lawrence E. Fields, the appellate.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Kitzman, and with me at the council table is John Davidson. We represent the appellant, Sherry David, the wife, in a divorce case arising out of the Circuit Court of the County of Hanover. As your honors know, this case involves the appreciation and value of a separate stock brokerage account during the marriage. In the trial court was faced with that issue, and they found that the stock brokerage account had increased significantly in value during the marriage. The trial court also found that the increase in value was due to husband's activities in trading stocks during the marriage, and that the trial court held that the increase in value was thus marital property under 20-107.3, and the trial court allocated that. The husband appealed to the Court of Appeals and made three assignments of error, only one of which is relevant to what we're doing today. His assignment of error to the Court of Appeals was that the trial court had erred in finding that husband's personal efforts were the cause of the increase in value of the stock account. The Court of Appeals heard that appeal and ruled that the non-owning spouse, the spouse who did not own the stock brokerage account, my client, the wife, had the burden to prove or had to show that there was a proximate cause, that she, that her husband's efforts were the proximate cause of the increase in value. As an initial matter before the husband had to prove anything about the increase in value. The Court of Appeals held that neither party had presented evidence that would allow the Court of Appeals or the trial court to figure out what portion of the increase was marital and what portion was separate, and so the Court of Appeals said the entire growth was husband's separate property. The Court of Appeals was relying on a series of cases that the Court of Appeals has heard over the years, beginning in 1998, which puts on the non-owning spouse the burden of proving causation as an initial matter before any burden is placed on the owning spouse. Wife petitioned for an appeal to this court.
On that point, counsel, can you just give me a list of the cases that you think would have to be overruled in the Court of Appeals if we accepted your position?
Probably the major case, Your Honor, was Martin v. Martin, which was one of the earlier cases. I think that's 1998. I believe that was an en banc decision. And from there on, the other courts of appeal sitting at panel were obliged to follow that decision. So if that case is overturned, Martin v. Martin, all the cases that follow, which would include Carimbus v. Carimbus, Moran v. Moran, Roe v. Roe, Cerrito v. Cerrito, Gilman v. Gilman, and Robinson v. Robinson, which are the published cases, those would all follow in line behind Martin v. Martin. The wife appealed to this court, and her assignment of error was that the Court of Appeals, in following Martin's precedent, in placing the burden of proving proximate cause on wife before any burden shifted to the owning spouse, the husband, is in direct conflict with the clear language of Virginia Code Section 20-107.3. The clear language of Virginia Code 20-107.3 states that the non-owning spouse, in this case the wife, her burden is to prove that there was an increase in value and that there were personal efforts. And then the statute thereafter says that at that point the owning spouse, in this case the husband, has to disprove that there was causation. In other words, causation is assumed or presumed to have occurred if the wife made that initial limited burden. And these limited burdens are not unheard of in Virginia law. As I mentioned in my brief, in will contest cases, for instance, the moving party trying to set aside the will must prove undue influence, but doesn't have to do that as an initial matter. Rather, the moving party must only show that there was a will, there was an elderly person, there was a person in position of competence, etc. And once that limited showing of proof is made, undue influence is presumed. That fact arises by presumption, and the burden switches to the non-moving party to disprove that fact that arose by presumption.
Counsel, yes, ma'am. I know that you're focusing on language that's in Code Section 20-107.3, subsection A3.
Yes, ma'am.
If we accept your interpretation of that particular provision, what do we do with the language that's in A1 that talks about separate property? Because I think everybody agreed here that this was separate property and that we're talking about the increase in value. And that section says the increase in value due to personal efforts or contribution of marital property may have contributed to such increases unless the marital property or the personal effects of either have contributed to such increases. So it seems to me that that language, which I grant you is different than the language in A3, suggests that whoever's claiming that there is part of this is not separate property has to show at least some causal connection between the personal effort and the increase in value.
Yes, and I agree. If the statute only contained A1, which it did before 1991, if it was only A1, it would resemble most statutes in the Virginia Code. Most statutes don't specifically deal with burdens of proof. Most statutes simply state the ultimate issue, perhaps some definitions, and then the general burden of proof would arise, which is the party trying to establish a position has that general burden of proof. So if A1 was standing alone, absolutely, I wouldn't be here and we wouldn't be here.
But it doesn't. So I'm trying to figure out how we can interpret this entire statute without rendering some part of it superfluous.
I don't think it does render it superfluous, Your Honor. The first part is a general definitional statement, like many of the statutes.
Well, no, the first part is dealing with separate property.
Yes, ma'am.
Subsection 3 deals with property that's classified as both marital and separate. So I read some of the Court of Appeals cases as suggesting that when you start out with separate property, which this everybody acknowledges is, we're not fighting over that, then there's a burden for the person who's claiming that it's a mixed to make this causal connection to get us to subsection 3.
If the statute indicated that, I would agree with you. When the legislature added section A3 and spoke specifically about burdens of proof, it laid out a framework for the trial court to follow and how to arrive at the ultimate issue. I agree with you, Your Honor, that the ultimate issue for the trial judge to determine is, were there personal efforts? Was there an increase in value, and did one cause the other? That's the ultimate issue. Just like in a will contest, the ultimate issue is whether there was or was not undue influence. The question is how we get there, and I think the legislature gave us a roadmap for how to get there. First, the wife, or in this case the wife, the non-owning spouse has a limited burden of proof. And I think the legislature was very clear about that. They said that the non-owning spouse must only prove A and B. The word burden and the word proof are not contained in Section A. It's a general section. And if we took the general section and melded it down into the specific section, it sort of created a homogeneous statute, somehow squished the two together. The legislature could have easily done that. Instead, they added a very specific section. All they had to do, the legislature, was add, and the non-owning spouse must prove, in Section A1, and they would have been done. If their intent was to put the initial burden, just like in a will contest case, on the non-owning spouse, they could have done that very easily. Or, when they chose to add a very specific section, which they hardly ever do in the code, so it's a very narrow sort of circumstances, they could have chosen at that point to say, the burden on the non-owning spouse is to prove. They could have simply restated A1. Instead, they restated something smaller. So to agree with you and to agree with my colleague would be to say that the court should take two, a general and a specific, meld them together, and end up with the general, which was already there.
So give me a situation in which we would use the language in subsection A1.
I think that the trial judge is faced with the ultimate decision of whether there have been personal efforts, like I said, significant increase, and that one caused the other. And the way it's going to work and how it works in many cases is, and in fact many of the courts of appeals cases, both sides put on evidence. So the situation we have here is that the non-owning spouse would put on limited evidence to establish that there's an increase.
No, you're not answering my question.
Yes, ma'am.
My question is, give me a circumstance when A1 would apply, that we would use that language which has a causal connection in it.
I don't think you'd ever use A1 just standing alone. And the courts.
So then we would indeed render that language superfluous.
It wouldn't render it superfluous.
Well, if there's no circumstance in which it applies.
I think it applies in every case, Your Honor. If you took out A1 and you only had Section A3, you would have a burden.
This would be an easy case.
It would be. If there was only Section A3, you would state forth the burdens of proof, but there's no ultimate issue for the trial judge to determine. It's like in any other statute where there's no burden of proof, where it says, you know, breaking and entering is this, and so forth. The trial judge has to determine that at the end of the case.
Let me.
Yes, sir.
Are you finished?
Go ahead.
Let me direct you to A1 little IV, which says, as separate property is all property, and it includes that part of any property classified as separate pursuant to subdivision A3. So doesn't that send you to A3, and then you decide what portion of that brokerage account is separate and what portion is marital under the language of A3?
Yes, I agree. And I think what the legislature was trying to do, again, was to set forth as a general matter, then it directs you to a roadmap of how to make that decision.
And then the question that the chief has asked you is that last sentence would apply to property that is not part marital and part separate under A3.
That's correct. There are many cases
which then brings it under A1.
That's true. There are many cases where the burden won't be met or that there's just simply no facts to support it, and so the general language would make the property separate, and it would cover all those cases where...
In other words, if you looked at A3 and it didn't, you couldn't prove that it was any part of that brokerage account was separate, then A1 would apply.
Yes, sir.
And that language would be appropriate. So it would work both ways.
I agree.
Okay.
That was a friendly question.
I would like to reserve my time 3 minutes at the end unless you all have any questions you'd like to ask me at this time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, I'm Lawrence Deal. I represent Robert David, the appellee in this matter. Robert David did not own, manage, or do any efforts that were applied directly to any of these stocks. And that's why there's no causation as a factual matter that we get to the threshold issue of how we get to a argument that the increase is a result of personal efforts. The definition of personal efforts says those are efforts applied directly. And we have case after case after case that has indicated that acumen of selling, whether it's negotiating stock in the Roe case, whether it's trying to do an auction sale and promote that sale in the Carambas case, all of these types of things do not change the inherent underlying character of the property. And therefore, there is just no causation in this case at all because Mr. David did not own the family, American Family, or the other stocks that were involved here. And he had limited time. I think the record is clear on that as far as the factual findings of the court. I think they are narrow. Let me address the statute, though, that's been addressed. Look at the language of 3A first. And it says and repeats in that section, not just what's in A1, but the result and causation. Because we've traditionally had in all family law burdens of proof under Bowers and those kinds of cases. And it's repeated that it has to have contributed and result. Then let's go to the next section. In isolation, they're not reading the overall scheme of what we have always traditionally tried and done and negotiated and settled, which would be impaired and impacted by a reversal of Martin. It would put this statute on its head, frankly. But look at the last two sentences. It says, once the burden of proof is met, the owning spouse shall bear the burden of proving that the increase in value or some portion thereof was not caused by the contributions of marital. Well, if he has to prove it's not caused, then that certainly is language that is consistent with saying there has to be a causation relationship. That's right in there. I recall a part of a decision.
But it's not the same thing as saying the wife has the burden to prove the causation.
I would disagree because
how
I think...
How are those two the same?
Well, if he has to prove it wasn't caused by the contribution of personal effort, and we're dealing with personal effort in this case, then what's the meaning of not caused? Because it implies the wife has to prove the initial causation from the outset. And that's what's in 3A and A1 also. In other words, the husband then has to show that it wasn't caused by those contributions.
But that's not correct. That paragraph says the wife has two burdens to show that the contribution, that some contributions of marital or personal effort were made. That's one. And two, that the separate property increased in value. And then if he wants to show that the increase was not caused by his contributions, but by market forces, then the burden's on him. That
makes
sense to me.
There has to be an initial causation and proximate cause relationship to even get to that point. I've given you some examples in my brief of absurd results that are going to happen if you just said the bare bones is personal effort. And don't forget, the definition of personal effort is intellectual skill or other things applied directly to that asset.
But then you're talking about the sufficiency of the evidence for proving personal effort.
But it ties into why Judge Elder was exactly right in finding that there was a burden to have that causation. And it would, you know, there wasn't any in this case. You're correct. That's a factual issue, but it relates to why Judge Elder in this case was correct in reversing the trial judge, because the trial judge made erroneous applications of that and found that there was a causation that wasn't there. This is the heart of the case, is what was the nexus and what was the burden? And there's no proof under any scenario that there was a deciding to sell 14 days out of 2,109 days and a couple of days had anything to do with how that stock rose or fell.
Let's go back to the statute, though. Let me ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. If you're under A1 little IV and you're trying to figure out what property is separate, it says that part of any property classified as separate pursuant to subdivision A3. So that would make me turn to A3. And I look at A3, I see in that second paragraph under A, for purposes of this subdivision, the non-owning spouse shall bear the burden of proving that contributions of marital property or personal effort were made and that separate property increased in value. That's all the burden on the wife. And then the burden shifts to the husband to show that the increase in value, which is that part that would be marital.
Well, I think you're writing out the implication that there should be a causation, and there is by implication.
Well, explain to me how I'm writing it out.
Let me explain what the committee was trying to do with this statute and why it was passed. I think it would be helpful to give you the facts.
Okay, situation. If you're going to get around and tell me how I'm writing it out, that'd be great.
Roe is a perfect example of how this statute should work and did work. Prior to this new amendment of the bottom part of that A3, the concern was that the wife would not only have to show that there was effort, but would this decision to buy a contract an increase of $10,000 this
dollar for dollar almost, yeah.
Yeah, and so the concern was that's an impossible burden. How can you say this phone call to buy this contract or this negotiation related to a certain amount of the increase and quantify that? So we wanted to adopt what's called the marital effort rule. The marital effort rule is something from Professor Crosskopf. The Shank case that cited was part of that. They all relied, though, on the owner of a business that ran that business, not Mr. David, who only sold stock. It wouldn't matter if it's AT&T or General Motors. He didn't have anything to do with that change. So we wanted to ease the burden of that nexus. And so if the wife showed, as a matter of her burden, the personal effort, which is the effort directly to that, then it's an easier quantification of the increase to then shift it to the husband or the owner, and it can be female, to show other reasons. And the Roe case is a perfect example of market increase. That was a newspaper case in Fredericksburg. Third party, his brother was a settlement. There's a Congdon case where there were seven brothers. I was the judge pro tem. There's many of those that apply that. But what she showed was just husband goes to work every day. He did decisions. He was more of the national person that did. He was more of the day-to-day person that did the functions of the business. But you didn't have to quantify specific acts to tie it into the increase. So this was intended to ease that, but it's still never intended to change the result in or anything. Otherwise, we should have or could have gone back and changed that language. There still has to be a threshold nexus. Otherwise, the argument is, yeah, she did a... let's take the example that I gave in my brief. Wife plants plants in front of a building. Effort applied to the building. The husband's been retired. He doesn't do anything in operating it, but it went up in value. why should there be an impairment on trying to settle a case with absurd results like that? Why should a judge have to face an expert to come in and say...
Wouldn't the answer there be that planting flowers is not a substantial effort?
Possibly, but you're going to get arguments as to what is substantial and what's not. And that's an extreme example.
But that's a threshold.
But that's why we still have to have some nexus to get us to this level of burdens, because otherwise anything can really be argued to be an effort. And that wasn't the focus of the committee.
I'm sorry. I understand what you're saying the committee intended to do, but I have the same question as Justice Millett. And where in little I-1 and little I-2 is there a burden on the wife to show anything with regard to causation? If we're limited to the reading of this statute, if it's unambiguous, where is there anything in little I or little 2I?
The definition of the property under which section now?
A3A.
Okay, the first part of it says that the increase and personal efforts of either party have contributed, there's a causation there, and provide that any such personal efforts must be significant and result. So there has to be that the word result means a causation. That's right up there. That was not changed when this section was added.
But then to the extent that the General Assembly goes on to break out the burdens of proof in the last paragraph in A3, that second paragraph, they actually go through the effort of breaking out the burdens of proof. Can we find a burden of proof on the wife or the non-owning spouse in little I or little 2I?
I think what Martin and all of these other cases have done is read the statute as a whole. It would be, I think, an absurd result, which you don't intend to interpret statutes on, to say that the wife doesn't have to meet that initial burden. And so, therefore, the causation is in there, because the second sentence of that, after that, says it was not caused by those contributions, which implies that it was caused. Remember the Tucker case we had, it was an issue about, well, the judge said he had to pay future support, but didn't say it was retroactive. Well, obviously the implication is it was retroactive. It's here, same kind of thing. It was not caused by contributions of personal effort. Therefore, he had to meet that burden, implied that stated that that was what had to be shown. Otherwise, he wouldn't have to rebut anything. I think that the Martin case properly integrated all parts of the statute, and the word contribute and result have always been in there. And as a policy matter, it doesn't harm the effect of what we were trying to do, because the statute does now shift to the husband to come back and say, here's other reasons that now the increase is not merit.
Well, but isn't the whole philosophy behind that, that the owning spouse is the one who has the most information to prove the point you were making the flowers versus whatever the effort is? I mean, the owning spouse is the one that has all the information. That's why the burdens are set out that way.
Yes, but the factual situation has to be something that shows an initial reason to get to that point. And in this case, again, Mr. David didn't have anything to do with the increases of the stocks. And therefore, if you read Judge Elder, what he's saying is that she didn't meet that initial threshold burden of showing personal effort was made. I mean, you can read into the personal effort. It's applied directly.
That, again, is a sufficiency of the evidence.
Well, the definition of not
here's,
really.
Here's what, this is the ruling in the case. Because wife failed to sustain her burden of proving to what extent husband's personal efforts contributed to the substantial appreciation of his brokerage account, the trial court lacks sufficient evidence to make such a determination on remand. Well, the beginning of that sentence is because wife failed to sustain her burden of proving. And what we're trying to understand is where is it in the statute that it says the wife has the burden to prove it?
Okay, I'll answer that. Under the statute, under 1, it says contributions of personal effort. The definition of personal effort is those actions directly applied, a causation nexus. And therefore, it is in the statute in that sense. And what Judge Elder analyzed was the fact that there was no proof that he had changed the inherent underlying character and applied those efforts directly to the asset. All of these cases are consistent on that. If you just try to use acumen to sell and buy, that doesn't change the underlying value, which is what these cases are focused on. So if you read the statutes, it's contributions of personal effort. Personal effort implies a causation direct, because it says in its own words, And this is what the statute says, applied directly to that asset. In the cases where, like Roe, he went to work every day, that was effort applied directly to that. I don't think anyone would argue that. No one argued that in that case. It was the then husband's burden, because he does have the extra evidence and knowledge of, in that case, market value, the increase of population of Fredericksburg, and all of that. Here, the personal effort, and this is what the Judge Elder really focused on, was that there was no showing that anything he did changed the value of the stocks that caused the increase. He said that. In fact, the 1099s in this record, and we have to look at this case, clearly show that nothing was bought and sold. It just went up and down based on the value of that stock that he had no control over.
And so I think the problem, Mr. Deal, that we're having is that, yes, Judge Elder did say that, but he attributed it to the wife to be able to prove that. If he had said, and the husband proved that no personal effort caused the stock to go up and down, I don't know if we would be here. But because he said the wife failed to prove it, we're trying to find the analysis of the statute that places that burden on
her. Well, I again think that when he analyzed personal effort, and you look at all the other case interpretation of that term, it is the effort directly applied to that asset, intrinsically changing the inherent character, whether it's real estate, because of rezoning, whether it's, you know, the fact.
And maybe I'm missing your point. So I don't disagree with you that they have to show that it was personal effort.
She did have that burden, and Judge Elder said she has the burden of proof, and I think maybe he didn't say it exactly, but it was the burden of proof to prove the personal effort, and there was no personal effort shown directly tied to the stocks. And that is exactly how this statute works, should work, and should not be reversed, because we've relied on this for 20-plus years. It really does work fine the way it is. But when he said that she had the burden of proof, he was right, and there was no showing of how what he did tied into the underlying value of that stock. And that's really simply what this case is all about.
Counsel?
Yes.
I note an irony that in a prior life, you were at the podium and I was on a panel as we tried to determine the statutory interpretation of Title 20 for bills that had not yet passed in the same way, and I respect your expertise. When we look to how to interpret a statute, we use certain rules. One of those rules is that a later enacted statute is looked to in terms of how to interpret the prior enacted statute, that it gets dignity from its later enactment. A second is a specific gets the dignity over the general for a similar reason. A third is that we look to legislative history. And, of course, in Virginia, we have virtually no legislative history in most of the cases we deal with. Fortunately, in this case, that's not the situation. We have very detailed, very specific legislative history in the form of the report of the Family Law Section of Virginia State Bar on Equitable Distribution of Property and Divorce Proceedings to the Governor and General Assembly of Virginia, House Document Number 19, which you authored.
Yes.
Are you familiar with that document presently? I'm not going to ask specific questions.
Well, yes, and again, I referenced that when I was talking about the fact that the focus was on businesses that were run and operated by someone and didn't ever try to change the result causation of that level.
And actually, I'm particularly interested in pages 10 and 11 of that document, which very specifically deal with A3, why it's there, what cases it was intended to, or what cases brought it about, and how it relates to A1. And would you agree that we can use that document as persuasive evidence of the General Assembly's intent when it enacted A3?
Well, to the extent case law says that you have to look at the statute first, and if it's inconsistent, no.
I think our questions indicate that we have at least some initial question about consistency.
Sitting here, can't tell you if this final draft was the same language as we had proposed in the beginning. And sitting here, I just don't know. But I can tell you that we wanted to ease the burden of the non-owning spouse, let's say the wife, and mainly dealing with these business cases where, you know, she would have an impossible task to prove an act versus the qualification. That's what we're trying to address. Even the Schenck case that's in there talks about the owner of the property and having that, and it assumed that there was an initial causation to that.
One follow-up question.
Yes.
You would have a high level of confidence, though, that the original draft that was introduced into the General Assembly reflected, that this document reflects the intent behind that original draft. Uh-huh. So in other words, if I get that original draft as it was introduced, and I then compare it with the document as it was enacted into law, and I find that they pass the light test, that they are identical,
sure,
I can then look to this document as persuasive evidence of the General Assembly's intent.
Oh, okay. Seriously.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I think my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebecca?
Thank you very much. I have indeed done just what you suggested. And the committee's report has attached to it proposed legislation. And if you go and look at what was enacted and compare it to what was proposed, they are identical with some exceptions. There's some movement. The clause that was intended to be below this paragraph is here. It's the same wording. And there's a few non-substantial words, and is changed to a that or whatnot. But by and large, what was proposed, the legislature took it in whole and enacted it. You referenced page 10 and 11. I think the from the committee's report, if I could read it really quickly, the committee was of the unanimous opinion that a statutory enactment of such a rule would ensure that the intended results of the 1990 amendments to 20-107.3 would be promoted. The initial proof of personal efforts and increase in value would be properly placed upon the non-owning spouse. Once this threshold burden of proof is met, and that's speaking to my colleague's reference to threshold burden, is met, there would be a presumption that the increase in value was caused by the personal efforts or contributions of marital property. In essence, providing a presumption of active appreciation by presuming a causal nexus between the efforts or contributions and the appreciation of value. And so what the committee was doing was indeed suggesting a limited burden on the non-owning party. There's no doubt here that it is a limited burden, and there were reasons for that. My colleague suggested they only meant to get to businesses. I'm not sure that the committee's report makes that clear, and the legislation clearly doesn't just limit it to businesses. It limits it to all separate property. The legislative body could have limited it just to businesses, but it's a fairly narrow thing. So it is a limited burden. I think the committee intended it to be a limited burden. I think there's a specific reason why it was limited. And I agree with Your Honor that this is a later enacted statute. It's specific, and this is speaking to your question, Chief Justice, that the general statement does apply in many occasions, and that the specific language applies in some circumstances when there is a non-owning spouse who's trying to prove an increase in value. And that's a hard burden to meet if she had to do it initially. And that's why, if you read this and the cases from other states where it was almost impossible for a non-owning spouse to ever meet an initial causation burden, it's just very hard. And so the legislature determined to make it a limited burden and then place the burden on the owner of the asset to rebut that. And facts can arise by presumption. I think that's what the statute intends. The facts arise by presumption, and that's what the statute does. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but thank you for consideration.
All right, thank you. Call the next case, please.